Welcome to Only a Handful Radio, the podcast about learning from the everyday and everyone. Please enjoy this conversation with the one and only Sir Rafael Brion.
Before I call in the video.
But you can hear tricycle. Have a tricycle dito, Jam.
No, that's fine. That's fine. It's okay.
Makes it more natural.
Yeah. It makes it more authentic. So with us today is Sir Rafael Brion, or Lobo, as many would like to call him. He is a poet, essayist, professor, academic advisor, campus minister, spiritual guide, and friend to so many. After just a bit of a background on Sir Rafael, after graduating with a degree in economics from Ateneo, he pursued a master's degree in Filipino literature. He won the Gawad Galian sa Tula Poetry Prize in 1982 before graduating in 1985. His first book of poems, Baka Sakali, won the Philippine National Book Award in 1981. And in 1997, you guys aren't seeing this, but Sir is making faces. In 1997, Sir Rafael received his doctorate degree in creative writing from the University of the Philippines. And to date, he has written, translated, and contributed to over 10 books and compilations. Sir Rafael is one of my brews. He's one of my rocks. He's one of the few people who has seen me in my extremes. He's seen me at my saddest, my happiest, my angriest, my most lost. And he's one of the best listeners I know. And I'm happy to have this time with him this Sunday afternoon. So with that, sir, thank you for taking the time, always. I'm glad to have you here. I've always wanted to invite you, but I'm glad if we finally taken the time to do this.
Anything for you.
Nice. Okay. So I just want to start. I want to start where we kind of started. So just a bit of a background for those who aren't familiar. I met Sir Rafael when I went on my college, seniors retreat, 8-day silent retreat. So for 8 days, Sir Rafael was, I was with Sir Rafael. He wasn't my guide. He was a guide to others. But we would see each other almost every day, but we wouldn't talk because it was a silent retreat.
But I noticed you because you were eating so much.
Yeah. I remember when we finally broke the silence on the 8th. Ninth night, that was your first comment to me. Like you pointed to me and you said, "Ito matakaw to." And I remember my first comment to you, sir, was that although you were 60 at the time, you asked me, like, I don't know, I guessed your age and I guessed like 40 or 45. And if you haven't seen Sir Rafael yet, you'd understand. Until now, sir, when I look at you, parang ganun pa rin. So anyway, I only knew Sir Rafael. I only really knew him after the retreat, on the way back to QC from Baguio.
And we won't talk about that, right?
No, we won't talk about that. Yeah, let's not get into detail, but just to give a summary, we were on the same van on the way home and you were seated in front of me and I forgot what you asked, but you asked something and then it made me share everything, basically lahat, like everything that I was going through at the time, I unloaded it on you. So yun sir, and from that moment on, you've kind of became a guide for me. Even if you weren't really my guide for the retreat, you were kind of my guide We'd meet every so often, and we'd catch up. And usually in my saddest moments, I would call you and we'd have dinner and ayun, I'd unload again. It's always that unloading. And I want to start there, sir. I want to start with your journey as a guide, because you've organized a lot of the retreats in Ateneo, and you've been doing it even through the pandemic. And that was the first time I met you. So the first time I met you, my image of you really was a guide. And our relationship has grown that way until today. So that's where I want to start, sir. How did you get into that, into being a guide? Was it serendipity? Was it did something move you to do it? Like, how did that happen? And yeah.
Well, you know, even when I was a teenager, my friends would always talk to me. In fact, I called myself at the time. I don't know if you people still know a tape recorder. I would call myself a tape recorder without a replay. Now, people would talk to me about everything, about their problems. I'd listen. So, in fact, a friend of mine, I was older then. I wasn't a spiritual guide yet. But he said that he liked talking to me because even if he knew he was not the most important person in the world, every time he talked to me, he would feel that he was the most important person in the world for me.
Yes.
So I suppose I've always made people comfortable with me. They've trusted me. And then I became a teacher of Jesuits. And then I had friends who were nuns in the cenacle. In the cenacle, their charism is to give retreats. So I also learned from them. I learned how to listen to people more. In fact, I remember I had a young friend. He was my student. 10 years after he was my student, he was having problems with his wife and his children. And he would only talk to me.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And so even if I said, why don't you talk to this person or that person? A friend of mine who's a nun said, Rafael, if somebody just wants to talk to you, you cannot just push him away and bring him to other people. I said, but I don't think I'm equipped. And he said, well, then equip yourself. And so I remember the dean of it was still the School of Arts and Sciences, Dr. Ruiz, even gave me a subsidy so I could attend a marital and premarital counseling workshop for 2 weeks.
Oh, wow.
So I guess that sort of developed my listening skills and my guiding skills. And then I started going on 8-day retreats. So after, I think after my 10th 8-day retreat, one of the Cenacle sisters said, she was working with the campus ministry and she said, okay, I think you're now ready to be a guide. I said, but I haven't had training. I said, your retreats will help you. So the first time I became a guide in a retreat was 6 or 7 years ago. Really, I was already 60, I think.
Oh, okay.
In fact, I was more than 60 when we met. So the first time I went on retreat, I was a guide at the retreat. I remember one young woman was talking to me about something which I could not handle. Anyway, so my retreatant, I'm sorry, I called them my retreatants. The one I was guiding had a problem which I did not think I could handle.
Mm-hmm.
So I asked the retreat director, stress, and then she said, "Di mo kaya, no?" And I said, "Yeah, please help me." But then during that same retreat, there was this young man who was talking to me about his childhood, about his dreams. And I think it was actually just a 5-day retreat. I think it was on the second day when I asked him, "Do you have a vocation?" And he said, "Sir, wag lang ganyanan." And then eventually, he admitted that he had vocation. 2 years later, I told him to wait. I said, wait. Don't enter. He wanted to enter the Society of Jesus. He wanted to apply. I said, wait, work first. So I said, work for at least 2 years. After the first year, he came to me and said, I cannot wait anymore. I want to enter. I want to apply. I said, okay, it's up to you if you want to. So he applied. But then, about 4 years later, he left the society. But I understood why.
Okay.
And so I think that those two experiences made me feel that I could really be a guide. And then it was one retreat after another. And then I realized that I could listen, that I could help. But it was only last year when I formally joined a seminar for spiritual accompaniment.
But I guess, sir, like while you were doing it at the time, you were learning from your experiences. And well,
of course,
based on my experience, I think you've been more of a guide to me than I don't know.
Don't say that. Don't put down your original guide. I know.
I mean, you know, beyond the retreat, you've been there and you stuck. It stuck through all my drama.
So some people say that maybe my gift is that I'm able to talk to young people. Because I'm immature. No, because I like feeling young. I mean, that's why in teaching has helped me feel young.
Right.
And so I've always been able to talk to young people. And another thing, I think, is because I don't have children of my own.
Right.
And so, of course, I want to nurture. I mean, it's the father in me.
Right.
And what I like about my situation is that I can have kids, but I don't have to send them to school. I don't have to, well, I feed them, like I've fed you many times.
Yeah.
But I ultimately I'm not the one responsible for them. They have their own parents. And so I guess that makes it lighter for me. Mm-hmm. I cannot imagine myself being a parent. I'd be, my God, I'd die of worry. So maybe that's why God has just did not give me a wife, did not give me children, because I can channel His grace through listening to people.
Yeah, and you mentioned that before, sir. And when we would have dinners or lunches, you'd always have another appointment on the same day. You'd always have another date with someone or another a movie or a play to watch with someone else. And sometimes you'd invite me to them. So you're always, parang you're married to everyone.
that's what I say. If I were married to someone, then I wouldn't be free.
Right.
So, one reason, okay, I suppose, why I like being with people a lot is because I'm one of only two children. And my sister's about 4 years older than me, so she had her own gang. And so I've always wanted company. And when I was growing up, my parents were very protective. And so I couldn't even hang out in street corners, you know, things like that.
Right.
So my friends would come to our house and a refrigerator would always be open for them. So I really grew up feeding people. First with my parents' food. And so, yeah, that's where it's coming from. People have always come to me.
That's funny, sir. You mentioned street corner. I don't think we do that anymore.
I know. Of course you don't do that anymore.
But anyway.
When I was young, it was called being a canto boy.
Ah, right. Yeah. I mean, people still do that, but I don't know. I guess.
Yeah, because you hang out in malls or in clubs.
Sir, I want to touch on something you said earlier. You mentioned that with one of your retreatants, you asked, do you have a vocation or did you have a vocation? When I heard that, parang it felt like a, an odd question. Because to me, when I hear that, how would I know? Like, when someone asked me, how would I know? Is that so? When you asked that, sir, what were you trying? What does that mean?
I asked him that because his dreams, I mean, what he was talking to me about, his contemplations led to that. I felt that he had a calling because he was always talking about, you know, serving the Lord. And I don't just ask, I've never asked you if you had a vocation.
Right.
Yeah, because you don't look it. No, I'm sorry. But yeah, so it came from him too. In a way, I was just a facilitator. I don't ask that question. There are Jesuits who think every other young man can be a Jesuit. I've never thought that way. It was just that this young man.
Okay.
And he was the only one who I actually, in my several years of retreats, I've only asked that question maybe twice or thrice.
Okay. All right. I was just curious.
It's when you listen and then you sense something and you know, I had to wait for the right time. I could not ask him immediately. I had to gather more evidence, as it were.
Just to segue from that, sir, that's actually a question that I think a lot of people in my generation are always struggling with. I think a lot of us have this sense of being lost. And I think part of that is because we've opened ourselves to so many possibilities, so many choices, more than I think the previous generations have experienced. And because of all these options, we tend to not choose. We're paralyzed. And I think we've had many of these conversations before. I would talk to you about my own struggles, my own questions, and moments where I had to choose, like, is this right for me? What's next for me? And Siguro, with that, sir, how would you deal with that? I would ask you, like, Siguro, my question would be, what advice would you give to someone who's feeling lost? But then, of course, that's a case-to-case basis. It's always a different case per person. But how would you deal with that? Or maybe when you were around my age, what would you tell yourself, knowing what you know today?
You know, I think I had very kind and nurturing parents.
Mm-hmm.
And so they let me choose what I wanted, which wasn't easy, of course.
Right.
The onus was on me, right? But they also they gave me time. And so I think I learned to be patient with myself.
Okay.
And also I learned how to experiment, as it were, to try things out. Because, you know, I never really had a dream job.
Mm-hmm.
In a way, I was coasting along. You know, what came.
Right.
I was an economics major, but I was an economics major only because when I was in high school, that was the sexy course. It was a new course. And I liked my socioeconomics teacher in high school, and he managed to convince me that it was interesting. So I went to Ateneo, and I studied economics, and my highest grade was in English. I only got one A in economics. I even got a D in statistics for economists. In fact, I was about to shift to com. But then I had hepatitis. I stopped for a SEM. So I just went on with economics. And my parents allowed me. So I think that's what I mean by patience. No? And you know, I can tell you, I never really planned my life. I never said I would be like, well, of course, when I was in high school, I said, okay, I want to make, by the time I'm 20, I want to make a five-figure salary, which is nothing now, of course. But in 1970s, five-figure was like you're a millionaire. But anyway, And then I said at some point I wanted to write the great Filipino novel, you know, but I was in high school. So I think that's that, you know, you have to be patient with yourself and you have to allow yourself to experiment, to dare, to go into things. So that's what I did. I worked in my first job was in the city government of San Pablo and we weren't really doing anything. And I lasted 6 months and then I worked in a bank. And so for 3 years, in fact, for a time I was a bum, you know, I was just at home. I even started a business with friends. And then finally, I was 25 when I said, okay, now I will really go into my first love, which is literature.
Okay.
So that's when I studied literature.
So you mentioned that you at some point when you were around 25, you said, okay, I think it's time to go back to my first love, which is literature. You mentioned that was always what you wanted. That was your first love. Was this something that you always knew? Was it always at the back of your head, or how did that you know, just appear out of thin air?
Well, okay. The long story is that when I was a little boy, my father would buy us. It was called Junior Classics Illustrated. These were comic books.
Okay.
About fairy tales, and he, even before I could read, he would read to me, and then I also read he would read to me Tagalog comic books. You know, I grew up with that. I grew up in stories. My father would tell me stories about their past. My grandmother would tell me stories. I've always loved stories. My uncles, you know, every time I'd have a fever and I'd stay at home, I would listen to stories of my relatives who were taking care of me. So I've always liked stories. And since grade school, people always told me that I wrote well. And I had very good teachers in Ateneo de San Pablo. I had the best Jesuit teacher I had was in high school, Father Alfeo Nudas. He was very nurturing. He's the reason why I'm teaching. And for the longest time, he would always ask me, you know, even when I was already in college, even when I was already teaching, he said, oh, when are you entering the society? I said, no, you don't want me in the society. But anyway, so it's that. I've always had very good teachers. In college, I had Rolando Pino, the best teacher I've had in my life and the best teacher of many other people. Legendary, and he was my teacher. So I've had reinforcement, as it were. I've had encouragement because people told me I was a good writer. And then, what happened was, I was a bum, no? This was 75, I was 23. No, 75, 53, I was actually, how old was I? 22.
Okay.
73. Okay. 75 minus 53, I was 22.
Okay.
And is that 22?
That's 22. 50. Yes.
Yeah, I was 22. And I wasn't doing anything, but my father bought me a typewriter. And I was playing around with the typewriter. And I started punching in lines. And so I said, oh my God, this is poetry. I started writing poetry in Filipino. So I had four and I sent it to a local magazine. It was a Filipino magazine, but it was an expensive magazine. It was glossy. It's called Sagisan. So I sent in four poems. And the editor wrote me back and said that my poetry had promise. And he said that, I'm sorry, we cannot publish three, but we will publish one.
Mm-hmm.
So at 22, my very first poem was published. And 3 years later, when I decided, okay, I'll go back to school, I'll study literature, I had a teacher. I don't know. Maybe she was Benny Santos your teacher at all?
No.
Anyway, she was beginning to be a legend then. She's about 5 years older than me. So I enrolled in her class, and then on the first day she gave the syllabus,
And the only poem that I had ever published was in the syllabus.
What? That's crazy.
And I said, did you put it in here because I'm your student? And she said, no, I've been teaching that for 3 years, that poem.
What?
And so, of course, for me,
that's
that
a
was,
goal.
You know,
goals.
That was, yeah. And that's, she was the one who nurtured me.
Okay.
It came to a point when we would write poetry and I'd put my poem on her desk and then she'd put her poem on my desk. So it was a long running poetry workshop along with another poet, Ramon Sumiko, who's also legendary. So that's how I began. And then when I was 28, I won, there was a contest, a national contest for poetry writing in Filipino. For people who were below 30 and had not won any national award, okay, for poetry. So I joined it. Because a friend of mine said, Gina, you already have enough. I think I had written less than 20 poems. And she said, oh, you have 10. That's enough. Okay, put it in. And I won. And what really got me was, my idol then, until now, is a poet named Jose Lacaba.
Oh, I think I've read some of his poems, yeah.
So in fact, later on, every time I could not write a poem, I would read his poetry and then words would come to me. So the day that they gave the awards, that night they gave the awards, I was there. I was there with my father. And Jose Lacaba spoke as the chair of the board of judges. And he said, on first reading, the first time we read the poems, the three judges were unanimous. We already knew who would win first prize.
What? That's
so
crazy.
I said, well, if there is a sign, but I have to tell you, I'm a lazy poet.
Bakit, sir?
I mean, if you read my poetry, my lines, my
I have
my
I've read some.
Diba? My poetry is very short. My words are very simple.
Yes, the lines are also.
And you know what?
Short.
What makes my poetry in the beginning? What made my poetry were the readers.
What do you mean?
It was only after somebody told me it was a poem that I would believe that it was a poem. And one of the things I like about poetry is when you write, but this is also scary. When you write poetry and you show it to someone, they will see things that you did not even intend to put in that. So that's what I tell writers. You have to know that when you write something, it's like, and this is not new, no? I heard this from Rolando Dino. It's like giving birth to a child. The child is from you and your wife. But once the child is out of your wife's womb, the child is a life of its own. Or like a seed that you plant on the ground. The seed is a seed, but when it grows, it becomes a totally different thing. And so that's what I love about poetry, is that I am able to write things and people see things in it that I did not even think was there.
Right. Oh, yeah. I love that. I love the analogy of the kid.
When did we get there?
I don't know. I'm not sure. I'm not sure how we got there. But it's perfect because I also wanted to talk about writing after. In fact, it's one of the few things we really don't talk about, sir. Which is surprising because you're such an amazing writer, and here I'm also, I'm here.
And you are an amazing writer.
I'm an okay
too,
writer.
Right?
I'm
also
okay.
A writer.
I'm okay. I practice, so I want to talk about that as well. Something we don't get to touch on.
But I think you know why we don't talk about writing.
Yeah, because we talk about drama, sir. We talk about it.
Yeah, your own drama. Yeah. We don't have to talk about fiction.
Oh my God. Grabe.
Okay, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
No, it's okay because I'm just like, all the all the dinners and the lunches we went through, it's all just coming back. Oh my God, grab it. It's been a while.
I know.
But yeah, that's why we don't talk about writing. So I want to take this chance to so from there I want to go to writing. So with you, sir, you mentioned that it was from an early age you've kind of been, the seeds have been planted in your head, you know, when your dad would give you these things to read, and you were you cross paths with the right people to push you or to pull you in one direction or the other. But when you write, sir, what's your goal? Because for me, when I write, it's really just to improve. No, for now, it's really just to write something and so that I can remember that I thought of this. Maybe 10 years from now, I'll look back. This is how I thought when I was 23, 24. But for you, sir, like what is it to you? And maybe it was different in the beginning from what it is now. But yun nga, sir, what's your goal when you write, or what is writing for you?
You know, one reason why I write is because I cannot paint. I cannot draw.
Okay.
For a time, my father bought me a camera. I tried to take pictures, but it wouldn't work. And then people were telling me I was a good writer. And so I said, okay. So I write. My purpose in writing is to be creative. Well, there's this poet, Rambo. He said, when he was, I think he was 17 when he said this, he said, there's something in me that wants to come out. I don't know what it is, but it wants to come out.
Yeah.
And so in a way, for me, it's like that. I want, you know how I don't know, but I'm like this. When I do something, when I write something, when I arrange, like even arranging the furniture in the house, I always want to look at it over and over again. You know, when you create something, you're always fascinated with what you've created. And that's how so for me, writing was self-centered.
Okay.
I wasn't thinking of people that I'm writing this for. Well, of course, when I was in high school, I would write, I remember writing a poem or two for this girl who eventually turned me down anyway. So,
okay.
Other than that,
yeah,
you know, it's really, and so it was only when my readers, and these are my friends, when they told me how much they enjoyed my poetry, how my poetry meant to them. It was only then that I realized that I was really writing not just for myself. Especially when I started doing 8-day retreats, because what would happen is during those retreats is when I would write. And so my poetry became prayers.
Right. I remember during my retreat as well, I wrote a lot of prayers. And yeah, I would look back at them and like, oh, ang ganda. That must have come from a place that you only went to, you know, when you're at a certain mindset, when you're in a certain environment. And so yeah, I like when you said that writing is self-centered for you, it's kind of self-centered for you. Like for me, I relate to that. My reasons for writing, well, in the beginning, it was also that. It was also because there are so many thoughts. You know, like I'm juggling all these thoughts. And there are times when I would speak to a friend, they'd come up and I'd tell them, oh, you know, this idea, blah, blah, blah. And then with another friend, I'd tell the same story. And at some point I got tired of telling the same idea over and over again. So I wanted to just write it down so it's there. So I don't have to, because when it's just in your head, I feel like I have to keep this. I have to make sure I don't forget this in case someone comes along and I have to retell this idea. But now that it's written down, it's there. So in that sense, I think
I relate. But then, you know, every piece of writing, whether it's a poem, a song, or an essay, it's always, they're very different. Like you said, sir, each one is like a child or like a seed. And then when it grows, it's really the process is different for each. So with you, sir, is there, after all the years of writing, for you, is there a process that you take before you write a poem, or does it just appear out of nowhere spontaneously on its own?
Yeah, that's why I tell you, I'm a lazy writer. I don't say, okay, I'll sit down and write a poem. Mm. There has to be an occasion. The right time, the right place. That's why I need to go on retreat.
Okay, right.
Well, in the beginning, I would write poetry when I was down, when I was low. I couldn't write anything. Because you let emotions out. When you're down, when you're low, instead of crying, you let emotions out.
Yeah.
But it came to a point when I got so spoiled, I have to be on retreat. I have to be alone. Mm-hmm. And so much of my later poems are about nature. Because, you know, when you're on your retreat, you walk around, you... So my poems are really about moments. They're really more descriptive. Mm. My poems do not think, you know? They're not idea poems.
Right.
They're
right.
Image poems. And so they're more like haikus. In fact, this priest, Father Nudas, he was the one who told me that my poetry was so zen.
Right.
It's
right.
Focusing on the moment. That's why my second book. Yeah. The title of my third book is Sandali. It's really the moment. For me, the moment is everything. For me, the moment is forever. As we talk right now, for me, this is the most important thing in my life, this moment.
That's great.
So my poetry is like that. My poetry is like photography. It always catches the moment. And so there's very little reflection, in a sense. It's the reader who will reflect.
Mm.
Of course, later on, I mean, you know, I intentionally choose these words so that my readers will reflect, but if there is a process, that is the process. I just wait for words to come.
Yeah.
And so I have to be quiet. I have to be, you know what, but you know, when I was starting out, I could only write when there were people around me.
Maybe because that's your comfort zone.
It changed with age. Yeah. It changed with age. And right now, yeah. There was a time when I could only really write when I was handwriting them. But right now, I write on the computer.
Mm.
So I don't have drafts. That's the problem.
I feel like, sir, the way you write, from where I'm standing, it feels like you don't feel stuck so often. Most writers feel that a lot. They get writer's block. They find themselves not being able to write. But when I listen to you, when I'm listening to you right now, it feels like voila, it like whatever comes. Is that what is? I don't know if I'm getting it right.
Because you know, I have to tell you.
Mm-hmm.
No, you're right. I have to tell you. I tell people I am a. When I'm writing, I don't see myself as a writer. I don't even take myself that seriously as a writer. Seriously.
Okay.
So for me, there's no such thing as a writer's block. If I cannot write, then I'll do other things.
Yes.
I'll talk to my friends. I'll watch a movie. I'll teach. So for me, writing is not a big deal.
Mm.
But you know that in my life, writing has become such a big deal. Okay, so writing became a big deal for me because writing afforded me to travel.
Mm, right.
okay, my first trip to Europe was because I was a writer. And yeah. Then even I went to Iowa for the writing program, you know. Most of my travels have really been because I am a writer. And so I think I'm being unfair to my writing when I say I do not take it seriously. But seriously, I do not take it seriously. Like during this pandemic, I've written so few things. And it doesn't even bother me.
Right.
But when I get around to doing it, like in an 8-day retreat, my last 8-day retreat, I wrote, well, I can't call all of them poems, but I must have written over 100.
Wow. Okay.
Short verses. And so for the longest time, I would be posting them on Facebook.
Yeah, I would see them.
But we cannot understand your handwriting, but then a Jesuit transcribed my poetry, one poem. Because one of my friends was complaining that she couldn't understand it. He transcribed it and typed it and put it in as a comment on Facebook. And so people were telling me, why are you putting out your poems on Facebook? Aren't you afraid of being plagiarized?
Mm.
And you know what I tell them? I tell them, I don't care. I don't care. You know, our right. forefathers, before the coming of the Spanish, our forefathers wrote without caring who wrote it. For them, the only reason they wrote was because it would help other people. Because poetry then was ritualistic. You know, it would help you. Sometimes it would help cure someone. And in fact, for the Mangyans, they have this poetic form called ambahan. They did not even want to admit that they wrote that piece.
Oh.
Because everything was communal. So for me, that's right, fine. But right. Of course, when I was hoping to be full professor and it was important to publish a book,
yeah.
Of course, I was more conscious of copyrights. But now, I don't care. And besides, my poetry, I think, is not that great. So people will not even steal them. But then I hear people thanking me. And for me, that's the only, even if only 5 people liked my poem, and even if only 2 said they loved it, that's fine with me.
Yeah.
Because I get my kicks out of other things, like conversations like this, you know. Like, if we're talking like this, I'm not going to, if words come to me, I'm not going to say, wait. I have to stop this and I will write. No, I know my priorities. My priority now is talking to you. If I lose those words, then I lose those words. I don't care. So bottom line is I don't take my writing seriously.
Okay.
But I am so fortunate that other people do.
Yeah.
I've won how many awards? I have 3. I have at least 3 trophies for writing poetry. And there are pieces. 2 are by Manuel Baldemore. The other one is by somebody else, you know.
Okay.
I've also made money. You know, one of the best things that happened to me was... this was about 15 years ago, okay? So, a friend of mine invited me to read my poetry outside the Ayala Museum.
Okay.
In Greenbelt.
Okay. Yes. Okay.
So I read a couple of other readers. They read other people's poetry. They were actually movie stars. So I read my poetry. I think I read 4 poems.
Mm.
At the end of the night, they paid me and I was able to buy a pair of Adidas sneakers. With the payment they gave me for 4 poems. I said, oh my God.
Yeah. Sulit na, sir. Sulit na.
Oh, it's very sulit. And because of my reputation as a writer, now I am a writing coach. I have this. I'm coaching people to write now.
Oh, you should coach me, sir. I should avail of your services. Yeah.
They pay me.
Yeah.
No, with you, you can. And you don't need my coaching. You write well already.
I know.
In fact, you know, the women that I'm coaching, they write very well. They just need somebody to... They just need somebody to push them. They need somebody to give them writing prompts. They need somebody to tell them how good. Because they are good. writers already.
Okay. Okay.
Anyway, so
I want to next talk about when writing gets personal. I read one of your essays. This was from 1990 something, 1994,
1997. What was it about?
It was about the title was, hold on, I think I still have it here. And then they were gone.
Oh, it was about the people who had died.
Yes, yes.
Oh, that was published by some Australian thing.
I don't remember. I think so.
Mascara Review.
You're right, yes.
Mascara Review.
Yes, yes. That's where I found it. And while I was reading it, I was like, Javier, this is very personal. You were talking about family members, close friends who had died, and your relationships with them. And you had poems written for each of them as well. And that's when I was reading it, I was like, grabe, like I want, that's a goal for me. To be able to get so personal. But at the same time, when someone reads it, parang, you know, they feel themselves, they see themselves in your experience. And I think that there's, it takes a lot of courage to get that personal. But for you, sir, like how do you decide when something is too personal? Do you find yourself having these boundaries?
Okay, I think this will tell you what my limits are. Okay, that thing that you wrote, and then they were gone.
Yes.
I removed one section. There is no section there about my friend whose father committed suicide, right?
Right, no.
Because when it was going to be published, I decided to remove that because it might make the family feel uncomfortable. Because right. The father was a public figure. And so that's where I stopped. I don't care if people... Well, no, I don't put my life out there in public. But I want to write something personal that involves other people's secrets or feelings, or, you know. I don't want to divulge things which are not for me to divulge.
Right.
So, and of course, I am of the school of thought, because, you know, there are two schools of thought in writing autobiographical pieces,
okay.
In writing nonfiction pieces. One school of thought says that you have to be perfectly honest, that you cannot embellish.
Right.
The other school of thought says that you can omit, you can add a few things. I'm of the second school of thought.
Okay, yeah.
So even if it's a story, I can change the names.
Right.
And of course, I don't pass it off as their real names. So I guess for that I can actually couch the privacy.
Right, yeah, that makes sense.
So I don't trample upon other people's rights to their own privacy. And I do not divulge too much of myself. So, of course, hiding part of the truth is also truth, right? But the problem is, will you add some things? And I have added some things because I believe that memory is really faulty anyway. Memory is not perfect.
So, right, yeah.
Why would I even think about it if it didn't really happen? I don't know. Am I making sense? But
yes, yes, yes. Got that.
So, yeah, your question is, how do I deal with private things? Every time I write, I just assume that this will be read by people, and so I have to be careful.
Okay. Yeah, that's... I was just interested because... I sometimes find myself unable to write something because I feel like, oh, this is too private or this is too personal. So I'd rather just not you know, I'd write it, but I'd keep it for myself. Or maybe...
But you know, the other thing, though, is sometimes... Mm-hmm. Sometimes, the question is, why would anybody be interested in my life anyway? Because mm-hmm. sometimes, there is such a thing as navel gazing, right? You just...
Right.
And some writers are like that. But what do I care? Even I think, what do I care about what you're writing about?
Yeah.
But I also believe that there are all sorts of readers. Eh? Some readers might not be interested, but some readers might be. And so for me, bottom line is, if I think that what I'm writing is worth writing about, whether it's only for me or only for a few people, then I will write it.
Okay.
And then if I want it published, there are editors anywhere. The editors can decide for me. If they think it's worth publishing, then they decide it. My only vanity publication is Facebook.
Right.
And I used to have a blog. I used to have a blog in Filipino. But I cannot even... I can't even write in that blog anymore because I forgot my password. Somebody's to help me retrieve my password. But yeah, so those are the only times when I become when I self-publish, only on Facebook and in my old blog. Because for the other times, I think I leave it up to the editor.
Right.
If they think it's worth publishing, then they will publish it. If not, then they won't.
Okay. Okay.
But only a handful kasi is self-published, right? You're the one who decides whether to publish it or not.
Yeah, that's why I was like, so I have to.
You get feedback. Wait, you get feedback naman eh. Like you get feedback from us.
I do.
You get likes and we say it's, which means that you should continue doing it.
Right. But that's the trouble, like with feedback. A lot of people, me sometimes included, I'm trapped by feedback. Like when I write something and no one likes it, you know, like responds. That's a big deal for me. Cause you know, like you said, sir, each piece of writing is like a child, you know, I really treat each one like a child. It really feels like I'm nurturing it and seeing it grow. So feedback, I think it's dangerous when I base things on feedback, because it can really, because there's already a lot of self-doubt there. Like it pops up out of nowhere, but feedback can just amplify that and paralyze you to the point that you stop writing.
Yeah, that's why I'm lucky, because I don't take my writing that seriously. Yeah, I don't get feedback.
Yeah.
I don't like my poetry. Of course I feel hurt. I mean, of course I feel slighted if they say something about my poetry. But after a while, you just brush it off and say, well, there are other things I can do good well anyway.
Right. And I think there's... Sir, I think
But I understand that. I'm also very, very sensitive about feedback. I understand that.
Okay. Yeah, but that kind of attitude that, like, a person's opinion, you know, it matters, but at some point, it doesn't. You know, to a certain degree, it does.
Yeah, I think that's how it should be. I think the opinion that matters for me are opinions that will help me improve my writing.
Right.
I mean, constructive criticism, as it were. Yeah.
Okay.
But of course, one of the problems is that I'm too lazy to revise.
Oh, I'm also really lazy to revise, sir.
Yeah.
I have a lot of typos, which which is my problem. Sometimes when I post something, I would catch my mom or Imara. Imara does this a lot. She would send me my typos for me to correct, which I really appreciate.
Well, what you should do is before you publish something, send it to your mom or to Imara so they can edit it before you publish it.
That's a good idea. That's a good idea.
And then you give them some pastries as payment.
Okay. I want to go to the next part, which is more
education.
Education. Yeah. This next part is actually more, it's a bit selfish because...
Sure, because you will be a teacher yourself.
Yeah, this is more personal to me now. And also to those who care. I really want to get into this because this was a big and long debate in my head since high school, I think. It's always been in the back of my head. And I somehow always knew that in the end I would end up teaching in some form. But I never really knew or never decided to what degree until recently. I want to ask, sir, what having thought for many years, you mentioned that one of your teachers from, I'm not sure if it was high school or college, was one of the reasons why you teach. But to you, what was your main reason? Like, what made you, what was the click, if there was, that really made you want to teach?
Okay, believe it or not, I never thought that I would be a teacher, okay? So, because I was always frightened of being in front of an audience. But then when I went back to Ateneo to study literature, I was invited to teach.
Mm-hmm.
And then, if you're a literature major, what else is there to do, right?
Right.
And so I started teaching. In fact, my first teaching stint was not Ateneo. It was St. Joseph's College. I was teaching Filipino. And I really enjoyed being with my co-faculty more than in the classroom. So, And the first time I taught in Ateneo, I would call it a baptism of cold water. Like, people did not care what I was talking about. But then I had a couple of students in that class who were very interested.
Okay.
And so what really got me to like teaching was really the reaction of students. And it was relationship with students more than anything. But of course, also because of my love for literature. And also, I tell people, I teach because I have an unquenchable thirst for learning. Because I like reading, I like finding out things. And so it's a combination of all that.
Right.
But I think most of it is really feedback. I mean, reaction.
Right.
Of my students. I mean, I really teach for my students.
Okay. Yeah, that's cool. I think...
Oh, and you know, Jam, I realized that I really wanted to become a teacher when I'd find myself, like, I see something... Or I watch something and I'd ask, oh, this is good material for my classes.
Right.
And that even when I'm taking a shower, I'm thinking of what to do for my class. So I said, oh, I think I'm really a teacher now.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah. I relate to this a lot. And it's also part of the reason why I write. Like, when I see something or when I come up with this, like, when I piece things together to form this idea, I would want to share them immediately to someone. And it's the same. I like, it's also a bit self-centered, I think, but I like the feedback. I like the, oh, thank you. Like, you know, thanks for sharing that. And yeah, like, I get that, like, feeling a lot when I hear something new, when I learn something new, I want to immediately, you know, tell someone. And a lot of it is wanting to share. Like, I remember when I would, when let's say I'm watching a movie in my room alone, And then like someone comes in to watch the movie with me, but the movie's already midway through. I would feel really annoyed because they did not get to experience the first half. So,
okay.
So after the movie, my experience would not be the same as theirs. So parang sayang yung... I always feel that like when I experience something, I want you to feel the same thing. You know, I want you to experience the same thing. So I think that's why that's what attracted me to writing and to teaching. It's that I want you to experience the same, you know, parang sayang naman. Yung, yeah. So when you say that you're really teaching for the students, like, but I see, I get some of that. I think I relate to some of that because of this.
But you know, I have to admit, part of the reason why I write and even part of the reason why I teach, I think it's a form of yabang, you know, you're proud that you can do things and you like attention.
Yes.
I have to admit, that's part of it. Plus also, you know me, Jam, you know how the stories that I tell, I love talking. I love telling stories.
Yes, yes.
And teaching and writing, of course, allows you to do that. And so I think I have to admit a part of it is self-centeredness. I want to be noticed. Right. And that's very natural. It's very human, right?
Yes.
As long as you put it to good use. Right?
Yes.
Well, the biggest surprise for me from the past few months about myself and also about my teaching, and they're related.
Yes, yes.
Is that apparently I'm not that extroverted, that I can be an introvert too, that I can live without people around me. That I can be happy with just Zoom calls. That I don't have to see people. Like, I don't have to see you. We don't have to have dinner, but
right.
I can be happy with just a hello. Now, as far as teaching is concerned, the biggest surprise for me was that I never thought that I would work this hard as a teacher. Because right now, with the pandemic and online classes, I think this is the most I've worked as a teacher.
Oh, that's interesting.
Because, you know, I wake up in the middle of the night and I do something for my class and I only have three classes. And a lot of my time is occupied by what I will teach, but I don't know. And even in my dealings with my students through Zoom, I feel like that I'm a more caring teacher now. And for me, that is a surprise, a very pleasant surprise.
Oh,
I'm enjoying teaching immensely, even if I don't see my students face to face. Which means I think that I really am a teacher.
Yeah. Right, right.
In fact, right now, I feel like I'm a new teacher with this whole online learning thing. I never thought that I would get used to Canvas, but now I'm actually enjoying it. So teacher talaga ako.
Yeah, I guess that's how you...
And I'm supposed to be retired, huh? I'm supposed to be retired. I'm not even teaching full-time anymore.
I guess that's how you know when, like, even if you change the medium, like right now, sir, it's a totally different game. When you're doing online classes versus doing like classes in
real-time
person.
Classes.
Yeah, it's a very different. It's almost a different job, but.
Mm-hmm.
When you do it and you still like feel like, okay, this is still this is still right, you know, this still feels right, then I guess that's when you know, like, okay, this is really like I'm a teacher. You know, so I guess with that, sir, we can move on. What advice would you give to the future generation of educators or school administrators, having been there, you know, for years? I'm sure I can always ask my dad, naman, but I'd also like to get to get your thoughts on this.
Well, if I were to give an advice to educators, I would just say, consider yourselves as students all your life.
Mm.
You should be the first learner.
Right, right.
The teacher should be the first learner. In fact, somebody gave me a paperweight that said, teaching is learning one thing twice.
Right. Yeah.
So it's you never stop learning. If you want to be an educator, if you stop learning, don't be an educator.
Right.
The other thing, of course, too, is that you should always put your students at the center of your teaching.
Mm.
And when I say put the students at the center of your teaching, you're not just teaching them the subject matter, you're teaching them about life. You're teaching them how to become better people.
Right.
So even if you had the most esoteric course, you know?
Yeah.
Your center should still be your students and how they will become better persons. Yeah, right, that's it. I think that's my advice.
Okay. Yeah, I totally agree. Totally agree. To teach is to learn twice.
Yeah.
Sir, before we wrap up, I want to ask you these last two questions. These last two are actually, I stole these questions from another podcaster who I'm a really big fan of. I like to ask them, but I've kind of changed them so that they're kind of mine now. Anyway, first would be, do you have a favorite failure? And by favorite failure, I mean a failure that really turned out to be a good thing in the end.
Oh, wow. Do I have a favorite failure? Am I too proud to talk about my failure? What's my favorite failure? You wanna...
You can skip it.
You know, I don't know. I don't know what my favorite failure is. Maybe my favorite failure is not being able to shift out of economics and go to another field. Because I think because I stuck to economics, I learned a lot of things too, which helped me in teaching literature. Ano pa? Wala eh, I don't know. What failures do I have? I suppose one is that I was not able to get into the Philippines. No, I got into, but my parents did not let me go to the Philippine Science High School. Okay, I've led a very privileged life. In fact, you know, Jam, one of my cousins said, you will never become a great poet because you've never had any heartbreaks. You've never had any failures.
Mm.
You've never lived a difficult life. Because I feel that I truly am blessed. Even during this pandemic, I never had a moment when I felt depressed about the pandemic and about being isolated. I don't know, I've led a charmed life.
I think from my point of view, when you say that, I feel like that's mostly also because of how you view life. And you say that when you talk about your own the direction you went through in life and the way you write and the way you teach, you take it very easily and you just take things as they are. That's how I understand.
I never aim high. I think that's why I don't feel like I failed, because I've never really aimed high. You're right. I only take things as they come. That's why I just focus on the moment.
Right. That's big. That's a gift. That's a gift that many...
I know. It is really a gift. It is a gift. It is a blessing.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah.
Definitely. I think a lot of people can learn from that.
And so the lesson that I want to leave behind is focus on the moment.
Right. Yeah.
You know, my patron saint, I was born on her feast day, Santa Teresa de Avila. She's Spanish. She has a prayer. It's in Spanish, it's called Nada de Turbe. In English, it's really simply, let nothing disturb you. All things are passing. I'm just paraphrasing. It's a longer, I think it has like 8 lines. But if you sum it up in 3 lines, it's let nothing disturb you. All things are passing. Only God is enough.
Ah, that's nice. I like that.
And so that's why you focus on the moment. Tomorrow will take care of itself.
Right.
That doesn't mean, of course, that you do not plan. It only means that you focus on the moment and savor the moment.
Right.
And let tomorrow take care of itself.
Yeah, thank you, sir. I think
I like that even with my teaching, you know, I have something that maybe I shouldn't tell people because I'm a teacher. I am so charmed. My life has been so charmed that sometimes about 2 days before my class, I'll say, how do I deal with this lesson?
Mm-hmm.
I sleep and I wake up the next day and it comes to me. It's like words for my poetry. They just come.
Yeah.
Oh, so this is how I should do it. Really, you know, I'm not exaggerating. It really happens. And so sometimes I become complacent, even if I'm worried. And so it's close to my class. And I say, don't worry, Rafael, it will come. And it would.
Oh, it's crazy. It's amazing.
It is crazy. It's crazy. If I wouldn't even believe it if somebody else told me that. But it happens to me. Of course, for all you know, my students might be saying, ay, puro bola naman yung teacher na yan. He just makes it up. He just wings it. Anyway.
Yeah, sir, I like that. I think that's a nice way. That's a nice place to end it. That's
Yeah, oh, we can show each other's faces now before we say goodbye.
Thank you, sir. Thank you so much.
I'm sure
you're busy
anytime. Just let me know. No, this is Sunday. I'm not that busy.
Okay.
But...
if you made it all the way to the end, thank you so much for your time. For other stuff like this, other episodes or articles on random stuff, you may follow Only a Handful on Facebook and Instagram, or visit onlyahandful.com. Have a good day.